We present 221B by M.J. Reid, adapted for radio from the Sherlock Holmes stories of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, with Nigel Stock as Dr. Watson.
Properties for sale. Unexpectedly available. Substantial residence at 221B Baker Street. Suitable for use as furnished lodgings. Yeah. Comfortable rooms at a reasonable price. That's what we were looking for. First floor. Spacious, airy sitting room with two large windows.
Yes. Oh, damn rain. And two comfortable bedrooms. Yes. For many years, the home of the celebrated detective, Mr. Sherlock. To include all furniture and fittings, offers invited in the region of... God bless my soul. Reasonable price? Oh, damn leg. Damn Giselle bullet. Oh. Oh, ho, 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 ho. My old armchair. Good to see you in your old place again, Watson. Unexpectedly available. Unexpected indeed. And most unwelcome. Damned Alps. Obituaries. Yeah. Mr. Sherlock Holmes. It must now be considered to be beyond doubt that the tragic events which we recently reported as having taken place at the spectacular waterfalls at Reichenbach in the Swiss Alps resulted not only in the disappearance and death of Professor Moriarty of evil memory, but also of his long-time antagonist, Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the consulting detective. Dr. John H. Watson, Mr. Holmes's colleague and biographer, and friend. I like to think friend. Said he would continue to hope, despite all the conclusive evidence to the contrary, and quoted a favorite maxim of Holmes's: when you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. We wish we could share the good doctor's sanguinity. We are, however, grateful for Dr. Watson's lucid and entertaining accounts of the great detective's exploits. You may be familiar. No matter. Inspector Lestrade, the Scotland Yard detective, admitted that Holmes was a gifted amateur whom he was pleased to let in on some cases. He did not think the work of the yard would now be more difficult, or that the crime rate would increase. Gifted amateur! Bumptious little Scotland Yarder Lestrade. Holmes, the consulting detective par excellence, of course. But more, much more. What of Holmes the athlete? Holmes the author? Holmes, the philosopher. Many the evening I listened to him expound, I in my place here, while Holmes, dressed in a purple dressing gown from which I could not dissuade him, would recline on his sofa there. Holmes, the musician. You know, he once told me how he purchased his precious Stradivarius from a broker's in the Tottenham Court Road for 55 shillings.
worth at least 500 guineas. Off to violin land, Watson, where all is sweetness and light. Hmm. 221B. No man may take a last look. This is not an agency for the weak-minded, Watson. No ghosts need apply. Come, come, my boy. This'll never do.
Time to go.
Hello? What have we here?
Holmes, the analytical chemist. In this room, yes. We spent half the winter with the window open.
You know, my introduction to Holmes took place at a table such as this in the chemical laboratory of St. Bartholomew's Hospital.
I found it, he cried. I found a reagent which is precipitated by hemoglobin and by nothing else.
These were the very first words I ever heard uttered by my friend, Mr. Sherlock Holmes. You may be interested to know. Good. Well, it came about this way. I was serving as an army surgeon at Kandahar with the 5th Northumberland Fusiliers when the Second Afghan War broke out. At the Battle of Maiwand in July 1880, I was struck in the shoulder by a Jezail bullet, shattered the bone and grazed the subclavian artery. Damn nuisance. Sent home to England, where I had neither kith nor kin, so I was as free as air. Or as free as an income of 11 shillings and sixpence will permit a man to be. I was standing at the Criterion Bar one day, pondering my lot, when someone dug me in the ribs. A fellow who'd been my dresser at Bart's years before. Stamford. That's his name. No particular crony, but, well, you know how it is, a friendly face.
Well, Watson, he cried, how are you? Still a devil for the ladies, eh?
I ignored this skillful quip. Matter of fact, I'm more concerned with finding some comfortable rooms at a reasonable price.
Strange, said he.
Fellow up at the hospital is bemoaning himself because he can't get someone to go halves with him on some nice rooms he's found. By Jove, I'm the very man for him. I prefer a partner to being alone. Stamford looked at me strangely.
You don't know Sherlock Holmes yet, he said.
Why? What is there against him?
I didn't say there was anything against him. Holmes is a scientist of sorts, but he's a little too cold-blooded for my taste.
I mean, I could imagine him giving a friend a little pinch of the latest vegetable alkaloid, for instance. Not out of malevolence, but simply out of a spirit of inquiry. Admirable, of course, but when it comes to beating the corpses in the dissecting rooms with a stick...
Beating them with a stick?
Oh, yes. To verify how far bruises may be produced after death.
Oh, really?
I don't think I'm a faint-hearted man, but I confess that if we had not arrived at the door of the laboratory, I should have made my excuses and left. In the event, I was shown in, and a figure at the table cried,
I found it! I found a reagent which is precipitated by hemoglobin and by nothing else.
I stepped forward.
Dr. Watson, Mr. Sherlock Holmes,
said Stamford, introducing us. How are you? He cried cordially, gripping my hand with surprising strength. In height, he was rather over 6 feet and excessively lean. Eyes sharp and piercing. A thin, hawk-like nose. And his whole expression had an air of alertness and decision. A prominent square chin which marks out the man of determination. Stamford explained I was looking for diggings. Holmes eyed me keenly.
You have recently come from Afghanistan, I perceive.
But how on earth? Never mind. The question now is about accommodation. I have my eye on a suite in Baker Street which would suit us down to the ground. You don't mind the smell of strong tobacco, I hope.
And I generally have chemicals about. Would that annoy you? No? Good. I get in the dumps now and then. Don't think me sulky. Just let me alone. I'll soon be all right. And what have you to confess now? I was somewhat taken aback by this cross-examination. Well, I said, I keep a bull pup. I get up at all sorts of ungodly hours and am extremely lazy. And I object to row because my nerves are shaken. He became concerned. Do you include violin playing in your category of rows? Oh, a well-played violin is a treat for the gods, said I. Oh, that's all right then, he said. Well, I thought, this fellow thinks himself mighty clever. Well, doctor, if the rooms are agreeable to you, I think we may consider the thing settled. Somewhat bemusedly, I agreed to meet him at noon the next day, and we were shown over the premises by the landlady, a Mrs. Hudson, Scotch, charming little person. Holmes and I shook hands on our bargain and began that very afternoon to move our belongings into our new home at 221B Baker Street, London. Gradually, we began to settle down. I treated my new companion with a certain amount of caution in those early days. Bearing in mind Stamford's warning about vegetable alkaloids, I developed a somewhat eccentric habit of inspecting my food extremely closely before consuming it. But Holmes was not a difficult man to live with. Quiet in his ways, regular in his habits, and very reticent about himself. He was not studying medicine, and neither did he appear to be reading for a degree in science. Yet his zeal for studies was enormous, and within certain limits his knowledge was extraordinary. After about a week, the mystery deepened when a series of peculiar acquaintances from all sorts of classes began to call on him. And then, one morning, I was idly leafing through a magazine when an article caught my eye. The writer claimed to fathom a man's thoughts from a momentary expression, or by his fingernails to tell his trade. That sort of thing. Ineffable twaddle, I cried, attacking my breakfast egg. Fellow here on about deduction and analysis, armchair lounger. I'd like to see him clapped down in a third-class carriage on the underground and asked to give the trades of all his fellow passengers. I'd lay 1,000 to 1 against him. You would lose your money, said Holmes calmly. As to the article, I wrote it myself. Imagine my astonishment. My theories are really extremely practical. You have been wondering what I do. Oh, yes, you have. Well, I call myself a consulting detective, probably the only one in the world. When the government or private detectives are stuck, they come to me, and I am able to set them straight.
Without leaving the room?
Rarely. I have a kind of intuition that way.
Brag and bounce, thought I.
You were surprised that I knew you came from Afghanistan. Well, my train of reasoning ran thus. Friend of Stamford. Obviously a medical type. But with the air of a military man. Clearly an army doctor, then. He has just come from the tropics, for his face is dark, but that is not the natural tint of his skin, for his wrists are fair. He has undergone hardship and sickness, as his haggard face says clearly. His left arm has been injured, for he holds it in a stiff and unnatural manner. Where in the tropics could an English army doctor have recently seen much hardship and got wounded? Clearly in Afghanistan. The whole train of reasoning didn't occupy a second. Excellent, I cried. Elementary, said Holmes.
Oh, yes, he said elementary. What he didn't say was, elementary, my dear Watson. He never said that.
He yawned and lay back on the sofa. I finished my egg in silence, when mercifully the great Inspector Lestrade was before us.
Mr. Holmes, I wonder if I might have a word.
Lestrade babbled on for some time about an empty house in Brixton, and of strange words written on walls with blood. Mystified me, but Holmes made cogent remarks upon it all, employing his impressive logical analysis. Very well, Lestrade, it does present certain points of interest. Get your hat, Watson.
You wish me to come with you?
If you've nothing better to do.
Thus was I precipitated for the first time into a world I hardly knew existed. A world of extraordinary characters and bizarre adventure. All manner of men. Not only the human jetsam of life, but also, I'm afraid, the highest of the land.
Now.
In the empty room at Brixton, I first saw Holmes properly at work. He whipped out a large magnifying lens and tape measure from his pocket. His face flushed and darkened, and his nostrils dilated with a purely animal lust for the chase. He trotted up and down the room, sometimes kneeling, sometimes flat on his face, measuring marks entirely invisible to me. And all this accompanied by a running fire of exclamations, groans, whistles, and little cries of encouragement to himself. Extraordinary! He saw me staring.
Detection, like genius, Watson, is an infinite capacity for taking pains.
Your merit should be publicly recognized, I cried. You should publish an account of the case. If you don't, then I will.
You may do what you like, Doctor, said Holmes.
So I did.
Mind you, my style came in for some rough handling from time to time. Detection is an exact science, Watson. You tinge it with romanticism.
But the truth is, I embellished hardly a word of any of my accounts. The events were extraordinary enough in themselves.
You will remember the repulsive story of the Red Leech, the giant rat of Sumatra, The case of the politician, the lighthouse and the trained cormorant.
I ask you, embellish? No need, for the legions of bizarre specimens who walk through that door.
Kings, princes, sultans, notorious villains, upright business gentlemen, clergymen fallen upon hard times, all of them up and down Mrs. Hudson's stairs.
And the gentle sex, too. Decrepit old crones, stately matrons, and a bevy of delightful young ladies. Among them, one summer's morning. The most delightful of all. A blonde young lady, small, dainty, well-gloved and dressed in the most perfect taste. Miss Mary Morstan. About 27, a sweet age. She had a deep, rich voice, and spoke calmly of an anonymous message she had received, saying that she was a wronged woman, and to be outside the Lyceum Theatre that very evening at 7. When she'd gone, I turned to Holmes. What a very attractive woman.
Is she? I did not observe.
Not observe? Look here, Holmes. I have an experience of women which extends over many nations and 3 continents.
Good Lord, Watson, I never get your limits. But the fair sex is your department. I assure you that the most winning woman I ever knew was hanged for poisoning 3 little children.
I eventually called the case the Sign of 4. I was involved heavily, acting as a go-between and escort to Miss Morstan. She and I were thus often thrown together. A wondrous, subtle thing is love, for here were we two who'd never seen each other before that day. And yet now, in an hour of trouble, our hands instinctively sought each other.
I fear, I said to Holmes, that I may have accompanied you on your last case. Miss Morstan has done me the honour of accepting me as husband in prospective.
He gave a most dismal groan.
You do not approve?
Oh, no, not at all.
But love is an emotional thing. I should never marry, lest it bias my judgment. The division of spoils from the case seemed unfair. I got a wife out of it. Scotland Yard the credit, as usual. But what remains for you, Holmes? For me, he said, there is always the cocaine bottle. Yes, a chink in the armor. A 7% solution of that degrading drug. Give me problems, give me work, Watson. Only then can I dispense with artificial stimulants. I crave mental exaltation. Damn fool. Business, you might say, began to pick up with the publication of my accounts. Nearly 2 dozen cases, right up until... recent events. Night after night, at this very desk, scribbling away. Hello, what have we here? Good Lord! My original notes and jottings. Well. Oh, doctor's handwriting, scandalous. Case of the Mazarin Stone. The Boscombe Valley mystery. Silver Blaze. The case of the aluminium crutch. The speckled band. Dr. Grimesby Roylott, a nice piece of work. Holmes got me out of bed at 7 one cold and frosty morning. Come, Watson, come. The game is afoot. Our client was a young lady, Miss Helen Stoner. Sit down, Miss Stoner, said Holmes. You are cold. I shall order coffee. It is not cold, she whispered. It is terror. Holmes and I exchanged glances. It transpired that Miss Stoner was living with her stepfather, the last survivor of the Roylotts of Stoke Moran in Surrey. Grimesby Roylott obtained a medical degree as a young man and went to Calcutta. In India, he married my mother, said Miss Stoner. She had about £1,000 a year, bequeathed to my stepfather with a provision that an annual sum of £250 should be allowed to my sister Julia or I, should we marry. My mother died, and Dr. Roylott took us to live with him at Stoke Moran. And then a terrible change came over him, and he became prey to violent fits. His only friends are a local band of gypsies with whom he often goes wandering, and a cheetah and a baboon he's imported from the subcontinent.
Singular pets, eh, Watson?
My sister Julia, continued Helen Stoner, had become engaged to a half-pay major in the Marines. Then occurred the terrible event that has brought me to you.
Pray, be precise to details, said Holmes, half closing his eyes.
Our 3 bedrooms are on the ground floor. The first, Dr. Roylott's. The second, Julia's. And the third, my own. There is no communication between them, but they open onto a common corridor. The windows open onto the lawn. That fatal night.
Fatal?
I cried. I shall tell you. My stepfather had gone to his room early, and my sister was troubled by the smell of the strong Indian cigars he smokes. She came to my room. Helen, have you ever heard anyone whistle in the dead of night? Whistle? Yes. I've been awakened the last few nights by a low, clear whistle at about 3 in the morning. It must be the wretched gypsies on the plantation, said I. Very likely, said Julia. She left, and I locked my door after her.
You always lock your door? Asked Holmes.
Why, yes. The cheetah and the baboon. Suddenly I was wakened by a terrified scream. I ran out to the corridor and seemed to hear a low whistle followed by a metallic clang. I watched my sister's door open.
and stared, horror-stricken as she appeared, swaying like a drunkard, her limbs convulsing with pain. Oh, my God, Helen, it was the band, the speckled band. She collapsed in my arms and died before we could summon medical aid. You are sure of the whistle and the sound of metal?
Yes.
And the speckled band?
Delirium,
though the gypsies wear coloured headbands. Deep waters, Watson. Pray, continue.
She blushed modestly. I have recently become engaged to Mr. Percy Armitage of Crane Water near Reading. My stepfather does not object, and I shall be married within the year. What else? Oh, yes, 2 days ago, some repairs were started on the house, and I've had to move into my sister's old room. Holmes looked alarmed. And, yes, I did hear, or I thought I heard, a low whistle at night. An overexcited imagination, no doubt.
No doubt, said Holmes. Holmes determined that he and I should go to Stoke Moran that very day, Roylott being in town on business, and we agreed to rendezvous with Miss Stoner later. Well, Watson, said Holmes after she'd left, you don't mind assisting me on one last case before your impending trip to Arcadia? All right, Holmes. One more before I reform. Only madmen or ladies in love break bell wire, said Holmes mildly. Suddenly our door burst open, and a huge man stood framed there. His costume was a peculiar mixture of the professional and the agricultural. Black top hat, frock coat, and a pair of gaiters. And a hunting crop. A large, evil face surveyed us.
Which of you is Holmes?
Roared this apparition. I am Mr. Holmes. But you have the advantage of me.
I am Dr. Grimesby Roylott of Stoke Moran. And you are Holmes the meddler.
My friend smiled.
Holmes the busybody.
His smile broadened.
Holmes the Scotland Yard jacket office.
Oh, come now, really, laughed Holmes.
My stepdaughter has been here. What has he been saying to you?
Really, Roy, that your conversation is most entertaining. When you go out, close the door, for there is a decided draught.
Don't meddle in my affairs, Holmes. I am a dangerous man to fall foul of. See, you keep yourselves out of my grip. Ah!
And he was gone. Very amiable, said Holmes. Well, Watson, you've seen the opposition. Still game. Of course. Thrice armed is he who hath his quarrel just, said I. Quite. But bring your revolver. At Waterloo, we had no difficulty in catching a train, and were soon speeding towards Surrey. Perfect day, said I. Bright sun, fleecy clouds, buds bursting, and so forth. It is my belief, Watson, that the vilest alleys in London do not present a more dreadful record of sin than does the smiling countryside.
Oh. Oh, really?
At Leatherhead Station, we hired a trap, and soon, across a park, we saw the gables of an old mansion. We walked across to where Miss Stoner was waiting. We inspected the outside of the bedrooms and found the shutters would not yield. No entry there. Then the scaffolding. There seemed no pressing need for repairs. I believe, said Miss Stoner, it was an excuse to move me from my room. Once inside, Holmes examined her room minutely with his lens. There was a bell rope, fairly new. I gave it a tug.
Holmes! It's a dummy!
He climbed on a chair and discovered the rope was merely fixed to a hook above a ventilator.
What a fool a builder must be to open a ventilator into another room and not to the outside.
Roylott's chamber was sparsely furnished. Camp bed, stool, a few technical books. And, oddly, a large iron safe with a sort of milk on top. Hung on a corner of the bed was a dog lash of whipcord tied into a loop.
Ah, me. It's a wicked world,
opined my friend.
Miss Donner, your window would be visible from the village inn over there.
The Crown? Yes.
When you hear your stepfather retire for the night, open the shutters of your window, undo the hasp, and put the lamp there as a signal. Then withdraw to your original bedroom. Watson and I shall come across the park and climb into the middle room, next to Roylott's. Leave the rest in our hands.
We engaged an upper room at the Crown. Decent enough little place. The port was above mediocrity, and the proprietor's cigars less poisonous than one would have imagined. We idled away an hour or two. What did you make of the bedrooms at Stoke Moran, Holmes?
Well, I knew there'd be a ventilator before we left Baker Street. You remember, Miss Stoner's sister could smell cigars.
I deduced a ventilator. And did you notice the bed was clamped to the floor? So it is always in the same relative position to the bell rope and the ventilator.
Holmes, we're only just in time to prevent some subtle and horrible crime.
Listen, said Holmes. We rushed to the window and saw Grimesby Roylott ride past, lashing his unfortunate horse. A half an hour passed. Then, a bright light shone from the middle window of the house. Our signal. It was 11 o'clock. A moment later, we were on the dark road, and then over the wall to the park. Suddenly, out of a clump of laurel bushes, there darted a hideous and distorted shape. It threw itself on the grass with writhing limbs gibbering.
Is that you, Watson?
No,
it's the baboon. For God's sake, give me a hand through the window before I feel the cheetah on my back.
We closed the shutters and put the lamp on the table.
Do not go to sleep, Watson. Your life may depend on it. And put out the lamp. You'll see it through the ventilator.
I kept a tight hold of my revolver. Not a sound. Not a breath drawn. Yet I knew Holmes was sitting wide-eyed with tension only a few feet from me. Absolute darkness. Outside, the occasional night bird, and once, the cheetah. Far away, the parish clock faintly striking. How long they seemed, those quarters. 12 and 1. And 2 and 3. Suddenly, a momentary flash of light from the ventilator. Someone had lit a dark lantern. Then a small sound of movement. Silence for another half hour. Suddenly, another sound. Like steam escaping from a kettle.
Quick, Watson! A light!
I lit the lamp, and Holmes lashed furiously with his cane at the bell rope.
You see it, Watson, you see it!
I saw only Holmes's face, deadly pale, staring at the ventilator. Then, a low whistle. A pause. And then, from the silence of the night... The most horrible cry I'd ever heard. We rushed to the corridor and broke down the door to Roylott's room.
A singular sight.
Bolt upright in his chair sat Dr. Grimesby Roylott, in his lap the dog lash, his eyes fixed in a dreadful stare at the corner of the ceiling. Round his brow he had a peculiar yellow band of brownish speckles, tightly bound. He made neither sound nor motion. "The band! The speckled band!" whispered Holmes. I took a step forward. In an instant, the strange headgear moved, and there, reared up from his hair, the diamond-shaped head and puffed neck of a serpent. "It's a swamp adder, Holmes, the deadliest snake in India. He'd have died within seconds of being bitten." Holmes picked up the dog whip, threw a noose round the reptile's neck, and carried it at arm's length to the safe, and slammed the door. Next day, Holmes and I returned to Baker Street, stopping off at the Turkish bath, for which we both had a weakness.
How an English gentleman could behave in such a manner is beyond my comprehension, Holmes. You forget, the English gentleman was set to lose 250 a year if either of the girls married.
Oh, yes. You know, I'd have put my money on Miss Stoner's theory about the gypsies' headbands. Would you? I realized no assailant could come through the door or window. I had the idea that the dummy rope could be a bridge. Something passing through the ventilator. A snake was the only possible creature. And remember, he already had an imported Indian menagerie. But the whistle and the saucer of milk. Simple. He trained the creature to return by responding to the whistle, which it associated with a saucer of milk.
Oh.
The metallic clang was obviously the safe door. You see, the occupant of the bed might escape every night for a week, but sooner or later, she must fall victim. When I attacked it with my cane, it fled back through the ventilator and, in its anger, bit the first thing it found. Dr. Grimesby Roylott.
Yes. Well, I suppose, in a way, then, you are indirectly responsible for his death.
I cannot say it's likely to weigh heavily on my conscience. More steam, please, Watson.
Oh.
Back at Baker Street, Holmes and I celebrated. He could be delightful company when he chose, and I looked forward to a pleasant evening. Later, a cigar, perhaps, and I would listen to him prattle away about Cremona fiddles or the relative merits of a Stradivarius or an Amati. And then he would play me my favourite airs. Paganini. For the moment, oysters and a brace of grass. And something a little choice in white wines, Watson. I eyed the table uncertainly. And guaranteed absolutely free, I assure you, from the latest vegetable alkaloid. Oh, my dear Holmes, I never dreamed. Oh, you're quite safe. After all, where should I be without my Boswell? And for the first time since I'd known him, and just for a moment, I saw something in his eyes which was nearer to tenderness than I'd ever seen. To you, Holmes. And to you, my dear fellow. And the future, Mrs. Watson. Grimesby Roylott. Well, well.
After I married, I saw less of Holmes, but occasionally I'd receive a cryptic telegram asking me to join him on a case. Watson, come at once, if convenient. If inconvenient, come all the same. Comfortable rooms at a reasonable price. It was home to me. Right until the day I married Mary. Mary. So young. So far as I knew, Holmes entertained no close friendships, apart, I venture, from our own and his extraordinary brother, Mycroft. Nor had any need of them. But wedlock seems to suit you, my dear fellow. Ah, to be a married man is a completely happy state. You should try it, Holmes. And I knew the answer to that. Strong emotion was abhorrent to the reasoner in him. An irritant. Like grit in a sensitive instrument. Or crack in one of his high-powered lenses. Oh, by all means, smoke, Watson, if you must indulge your filthy habits. Mine! You know, I often come into this room and receive the strong impression that fire had broken out. Through wreaths of blue smoke, I gradually perceived Holmes. He had constructed a sort of eastern divan and was perched on it like some strange Buddha, smoking his oldest and foulest pipe. Silent, motionless, vacant eyes. Alarmed me at first, until I learned it was his method of working out a problem. Really, Holmes, I don't think he hates me.
London, the tentacles of a great octopus. If we could fly out of that window, Watson, hover over this great city, gently remove the roofs and peep in at the strange coincidences, the plannings, the cross purposes, the wonderful chain of events working through generations and leading to the most outre results, it would make all fiction stale and unprofitable.
Holmes had long held a theory that these chains of events, or certainly the criminal ones, were not entirely random. Time and again he sensed that behind each criminal convicted lay something, or someone else. A kind of malevolent organizer, as it were. One evening, my friend came home after many days' absence, looking tired and haggard. He sat in silence for a long time. I eyed him with concern. Eventually, he spoke. "I have found him, Watson." "Who?" "The master criminal." "Oh? Well, who is he?" "The Archbishop of Canterbury." "No. Professor Moriarty." I was dumbfounded. "Moriarty? The Oxford mathematician?" "The same." "Brilliant man." "Ah, but his talents have gone sadly wrong. At last I have found a slender thread that led me to the seat of half that is evil and all that is undetected in this great city. Professor Moriarty, the mathematical genius." "But it's preposterous, Holmes. An Oxford man involved with common criminals?" "Not a common criminal, Watson. We are dealing with Moriarty, the Napoleon of crime. I have been close upon him, and at last he has made a trip, a little trip, but more than he can afford. I seize my chance and wove my net around him. But Moriarty is wily. He knows my every step. There is nothing more for me to do until Monday, when the net will close. Hence it is vital to leave for the continent, for I am a marked man." At that very moment, as if to prove the point, the door opened,
and an unwelcome visitor stood there. An excessively tall, cadaverous man, large, domed forehead, sunken eyes, pale, ascetic face, and a habit of moving his head from side to side, like a reptile. The embodiment of evil. He peered at Holmes and took out a pocketbook.
Mr. Holmes? Mr. Holmes, you crossed my path on the 4th of January. On the 23rd, you incommoded me. By the middle of February, I was seriously inconvenienced by you. At the end of March, I was absolutely hampered in my plans. And now, at the close of April, I find my very liberty at risk through your continual persecution. You must drop it, Mr. Holmes. You really must.
After Monday, Professor.
You will never get me in the dock, Mr. Detective.
I heaved a sigh. But Holmes, eyes sparkling, alert as a cat, almost exhilarated. That's him, Watson, now do you see? But he won't give up. We made our way to Dieppe and on to Brussels. From Strasbourg, Holmes telegraphed to London. He crushed the reply in his hand. I might have known it. He's escaped. Lestrade has the whole gang but him. You must return home, Watson. I shall be a dangerous companion now. A sentiment hardly likely to appeal to an old campaigner and friend. So we spent a charming week wandering through the Rhone Valley, although Holmes was constantly on the alert for some attack. Then, over the Gemmi Pass, still deep in snow, and so, by way of Interlaken, to Meiringen. Beautiful, Holmes, said I. The dainty green beneath us, the white snow above. We looked out over the valley. My friend became meditative. I think I may go so far as to say, Watson, that I have not lived wholly in vain. If my record were closed tonight, I could still survey it with equanimity. The air of London is sweeter for my presence. In over 1,000 cases, I am not aware that I have ever used my powers on the wrong side. Your memoirs will draw to an end when I crown my career with Moriarty. Nonsense, I cried. You have much to do. He did not reply. At Meiringen, we put up at the Englischer Hof, then kept by Peter Steiler the elder. He recommended a walk to the hamlet of Rosenlei, urging us on no account to miss the spectacular falls at Reichenbach. There is little else to tell. We visited the falls. Fearful place. The torrent plunges into an immense chasm. Made me giddy. And the noise. There is a path cut round the rock to afford a view, but it ends abruptly at the edge. As we turned to leave, a Swiss lad came running along with a message for me. It was from Steiler. Apparently an English lady had arrived at the hotel in the last stages of consumption. You must go, said Holmes. But I can't possibly leave you. He smiled gently and laid a hand on my shoulder. Looked me straight in the eye. You have never failed me yet, Watson. Don't fail me now. Fail you? Dear old Watson, a fixed point in a changing age. As I turned to go, I saw Holmes with his back against a rock, arms folded, gazing down at the rush of water. It was the last I was ever destined to see of him in this world.
hurrying back, I barely noticed a tall figure dressed in black going the other way. At the hotel, I asked Styler where I might find the sick woman.
Sick woman? A what sick woman? My heart turned to lead.
You didn't write this note?
No. It must have been that tall Englishman who came in after you had gone. I raced back to Reichenbach as best I could. Holmes was no longer by the rock. I found two sets of footprints leading to the edge where the soil was churned up, indicative of a struggle. I shouted his name. In vain I shouted in that inferno. Something glistened on the rock. It was his emerald tie pin. Under the pin was a scrap of paper. My dear Watson, I write these few lines through the courtesy of Professor Moriarty, who awaits my convenience for the final discussion of those questions that lie between us. I am pleased to think I shall be freeing society from the effects of his presence, though I fear at a cost which will give pain to my friends, and especially, my dear Watson, to you. I should like you to have this jewel pin as a small memento of our times together. You have always played the game, Watson, and I am sure that you will play it to the end. Goodbye, my dear fellow, and believe me to be very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes. The wisest of men, and the best of friends.
Holmes was a man of habits, and I suppose I had become one of them. An active comrade on whom he could rely. But something more. I was a whetstone for his mind. He could think aloud in my presence. It may be, Watson, that you are not yourself luminous, but you are a conductor of light. I cannot give up hope. I cannot believe that great spirit failed at Reichenbach, unless he wanted to. He was stronger and fitter than Moriarty. There were no returning footprints, true, but he could have climbed the rock face. There were one or two footholds. And think of the work he could do incognito. It's not impossible. And when you have eliminated the impossible, Watson, then whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. You're rambling, my boy. 221B. No ghosts need apply.
Dr. Watson? Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
Come, Watson, come. The game is afoot.
Miss Morstan has done me the honor. Though not yourself luminous, you are a conductor of light.
Professor Moriarty awaits my convenience. Your memoirs will
Mrs. Hudson? Lestrade? Mary? What's the time?
Good Lord.
I should have returned the keys an hour ago.
I must have dozed off. Sign of age.
All right, all right. Prospective purchaser, no doubt. Come in.
Oh, damn leg. Damn yourself, bullet.
Please come up, my dear sir. I was on the point of leaving.
The rum old cove. Must be 90 if he's a day.
Come in. Come in. Come in, son. I was just taking a look round for personal reasons. I'll retrieve my coat and be out of your way. Touch of water in the air. We old uns need to wrap up, eh?
Bronchial deterioration, shouldn't wonder.
Here are the keys, sir. The keys.
Deaf as a post. Surprised he can see or hear anything at all through all those whiskers.
Are you quite well, sir? I am a doctor. Sit down. Sit down.
Why don't you? There.
Oh. Forgive me. For a moment, I thought... no matter. Well, I'll be on my way. I bid you good day.
What's then?
Eh? What's that?
Do you know me, sir?
That cough. Those whiskers. I don't believe it.
When you have eliminated the impossible, Watson.
Holmes. Holmes, my dear fellow.
Watson.
That was 221B by M.J. Reed, adapted for radio from the Sherlock Holmes stories of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Dr. Watson was played by Nigel Stock, and his unexpected visitor by Christopher Scott. Technical presentation was by Graham Harper. This was a BBC World Service drama production directed by David Hutchinson.